Deputy Director of Public Health for one of our health authorities. We have 10 regional health authorities in England serving our population of 49 million. NHS South East Coast is located in the south and east part of England, as the next map will show. We can get it to come. That is that part of the United Kingdom south of London, between London and the English Channel coast. The purpose of making this presentation is hopefully to complement the other two presentations. Namely, to tell you the story of, if you like, a management challenge to which we responded with public health leadership. NHS South East Coast covers four counties, Kent, East and West Sussex and Surrey, resident population of just over 4.2 million. The NHS, the National Health Service in England, is a single-payer, centrally managed, tax-funded system. NHS South East Coast manages the resident health care to that population, £5.1 billion worth, $10.2 billion US dollars. NHS South East Coast was created in July of last year by the merger of two predecessor organisations, one serving the county of Kent and the other serving Surrey and Sussex. And when they joined together, they brought with them different management legacies. In essence, Kent came with an essentially managed fiscal position, but Surrey and Sussex brought with them a £120 million deficit, $240 million deficit. So the new organisation came into being in July of last year with a deficit of $240 million and a requirement to clear that deficit by the end of our fiscal year, which was the following April, 9 or 10 months, and at the same time, obviously, to establish a new organisation. That, in a sense, is the history and, in essence, the challenge. Now, the predecessor organisation that brought with it the deficit had, in fact, been trying to work its way out of that problem for about a year. It had brought in management consultants who had undertaken a very detailed review of the situation and had concluded that some significant restructuring of the healthcare system was required. That restructuring would involve, in some areas, centralisation of services, in others, the movement of care from a hospital setting out into the community, in other settings, downsizing of some elements of the hospital's portfolio, and in others, closure of actual facilities. Now, the public reaction to that, understandably, was negative. There were considerable public protests, demonstrations in the street, and this was actually came to the House of Commons in a series of questions and adjournment debates. And the Minister of Health was put under pressure to come up with a different response. Now, the Minister of Health's response is clearly to refer it back to the Chief Exec of the NHS South East Coast with the instruction, sort it and sort it soon. So the challenge we faced was, how do we, in the face of over a year of public hostility, with a problem that clearly wasn't being resolved, address this issue and address it in a way that was acceptable to the population? Now then, with the creation of the new health authority, a new public health department was established, and I and my senior, the Director of Public Health, were newly appointed. And coming in from outside and looking at the situation, we judged that there were two things missing from the story so far. The first is that all the recommendations that had been presented for discussion so far were the product of analysis of essentially fiscal and activity data within the healthcare environment. And we judged that it would be appropriate to expand that search and that data analysis and to bring some rigorous evidence appraisal to that process. The second thing we judged was that there hadn't been sufficient clinical engagement in that process to date. There had been some, but this had been essentially a general management-led initiative to that time. So our response, in part, was the evidence file. And much of the rest of the presentation will show you extracts of one version of that evidence file that we produced. And because it's a very large document, there are quite a few slides, and I don't want you to concentrate on the detail. My presentation is available, as it was said in the afterwards on the website. I can actually send you a zip file of the whole thing if you're interested. What I want to do is give you a flavour for the approach and the content that we took. So, to start with, a bit about the what and why. And there are two clear things I just want to draw out of this for you. The first is, we wanted to develop an information resource that was accessible to all audiences. Clearly the public and patients needed to understand the case that we wished to make, but we wanted to articulate it in a way that brought in clinicians and other key stakeholders. And we purposely constructed it in a format that allowed for flexibility in presentation, namely a PowerPoint format to which people could add or select material and to which we could modify and amend over the course of time. And this is a document that is very much live. That was the structure of it. And there's only one thing I want you to take away from that, and that it is an explicitly public health approach to the issue. We start with vital statistics. We talk about the health status in epidemiological terms. I'm going to come back to health inequalities or health disparities in just a moment, because that is a specific issue we needed to respond to. From those, we constructed what you would be familiar with public health professionals as an assessed need for change. We then wove into that the evidence base around technological and clinical service change to try and bring in the clinical dimension, underpinned that with some agreed and negotiated redesign principles. I'll mention about Section 6 in a little more detail because this responds to a specific issue that the public demonstrations brought to our attention. And then there were a large suite of supplementary charts to which we subsequently added. Let me respond to the health inequalities question. The southeast of England is a relatively wealthy part of the United Kingdom. It is the second wealthiest in gross economic terms. It is second only to London, and London, like New York, bases most of its wealth on the financial services industry, namely the city. So it is a relatively well-off part of the country. It is also a relatively healthy part of the country. On most public health indicators, it either ranked first or second. So one of the issues we were anxious to do was to say, but amidst all of this, there were significant disparities in health experience and health outcome. So in making our case for change, let us not forget those issues. And we did this by constructing some simple analytical charts to help people recognize what we were trying to say. Now, they may look complicated, but of course, much of this will be familiar in terms of format to people in this audience. The point is that they allow us to demonstrate graphically that within a relatively wealthy population are clearly communities who are experiencing significant socioeconomic difficulties. That translates into poor health. That in fact can be found in all parts of the region if you look for it in small enough areas, that these inequalities correspond to significant differences, for example, in deaths, and this is true if you look at life expectancy or any other number of perspectives. So, for example, in the southeast of England, we are generally experiencing above national average improvements in life expectancy, but some communities are not. And when we take the aggregate of all experiences, most places are in that top right quadrant, doing better than the national average, but there's a mixed picture in other places, and other places are clearly getting left behind. So we brought all of that information, demography, epidemiological, description of the health status, the health disparities, and we started to weave in now some of the case for change. And this is where we began by drawing back on what the management consultants had already told us. What we were anxious to do was not to reject the very good analysis that had already been done. This was still relevant, this still had to be taken account of. We still spent per head more than other places. And yet we had longer waiting lists for elective admission. We were making above average utilization of emergency room facilities. That we were generating more admissions out of those emergency room admissions. The average length of stay was slightly above national average. And our day case rates were not as high as they could be. In short, we wanted to make the point that there were economic and real inefficiencies in the system. But we didn't want to play on those as the key issue. We wanted to contextualise those in a public health context. And we translated this using international comparators to put this into opportunity costs for the NHS in our area. And then we began to bring in some of the clinical evidence, the relationship between outcomes and volume effect, the trends towards centralisation and subspecialisation, and what are the consequences of those, translated numerically into mortality reductions that we might expect in our communities, how centralisation and decentralisation were not mutually exclusive. This wasn't a zero-sum game. And then, in order to keep the physicians on board, we needed to acknowledge some of the medical Royal College evidence base to support service change. We responded to expert reports as they were coming out, demonstrating the live nature of this document, and we took account of statutory and regulatory changes that were also happening at the same time. So having assembled, in effect, the public health and the clinical case for change, we then had to mop up a few specific issues. Now, access to care was perceived as a critical issue for the public. The public's concern was that if certain facilities were downgraded, as they would describe it, or even closed, they'd have to travel further for care. The consequence of that would be an increased risk to their personal health, particularly in urgent or emergent situations. So again, working with clinicians, we began to look at the evidence underpinning that. So we looked at the notion of the golden hour that the local MPs retorted was a critical feature for service design. We looked at the evidence for that, and we sought to get some agreement on what that evidence was telling us. We drew attention to other relevant issues around out-of-hospital field assessment and pre-hospital response. And we also fed into this the whole notion of different models of urgent and emergent care and the emerging nature of other roles in addressing first response, particularly paramedics. We acknowledge that the clinical evidence was strongest for certain areas, for example, primary angioplasty as a first response to acute coronary events. But our key conclusion that we reached, and we wanted to, if you like, be the takeaway message, was that what was more important was about getting to the right hospital, not necessarily the nearest hospital. So this just then shows you the number of the headings we used for the supplementary charts, a whole suite of these, demographies, more slides on health inequalities, some areas that weren't explicitly built into the main report, behaviour and lifestyle. And then an issue that we responded to, particularly the clinicians who were anxious to try and prove how vital it was to maintain the very wide range of services at every location, was to challenge them by looking at hospital utilisation. And we have since expanded that analysis to look at estimates of potential avoidable admissions. So then, in the last few minutes, what did we learn from all of that? Well, we came into a difficult change management situation. In the height of public protest, clearly not at the beginning, and anyone who talks about change management says that there are basically three absolute musts. You need to create a sense of urgency, you need to galvanise a coalition, and you need to build a strategic vision. We were starting from a position of considerable noise where none of those conditions existed. So post priori, we were attempting to try and achieve those three change management features. Now, I'm not going to try and persuade you that we have done this. This is work in progress, and we are probably at least a year or two away from seeing some tangible outcomes to all of this. We are currently consulting on some real service proposals now, and we are experiencing some, what I would like to call in a non-patronising way, some intelligent and constructive public debates around this, based on the narrative we've created with the evidence file. The second thing we learned is a very sort of technical one. The evidence file itself, we had this somewhat grandiose notion that this one information resource might serve a very large number of audiences. Clearly that wasn't a realistic proposition. And we have had to tailor this. And working with communications leads and public representatives, we have made certain modifications for certain audience settings. But with those two things, in my final comments, I would say that we are now making some progress a year on from starting this exercise, from a position where for nearly 18 months we'd been essentially at standstill. And just incidentally, as a footnote, that $240 million deficit, by the way, has been cleared. And it's been cleared by actually bringing in some proper rigorous accounting and some proper financial discipline to existing systems, and without, as yet, making any significant strategic changes to services. I'm happy to take questions perhaps at the end or even now, I don't mind which. Talk to people afterwards, and as I say, you can get a copy of my presentation off the website or subsequently by email. Well, what we've been doing is working with our primary care organisations who are most close to local populations, and indeed local directors of public health, through a series of what I guess you might call in the US town hall style meetings, where we've essentially presented a short version of this narrative appropriate to that audience, a narrative that has been agreed and negotiated with key stakeholders in that community. And then essentially we've opened up a dialogue. Now the key message is, and it is interesting that you've responded by referring to the best hospital. We've had a considerable challenge persuading people that best is not necessarily nearest. And that has been one of our most difficult. So to the first part of your question, in essence, we first of all had to persuade people that in fact the notion of the right or best hospital should have primacy over the nearest hospital before we're able to then get to the discussion then about which hospital. Now we're still working through those discussions. We do know from some of the evidence that some of our hospitals clearly are unfit for purpose, hence the fit for the future title of this presentation. They're clearly designed for a different era, built in the Victorian era, the wards, the outpatient facilities, the ambulatory care services are just not appropriate to modern technology, healthcare technology. And we've had to have that dialogue with people, and we're beginning to make some progress.